Good morning. I'm Rich Simon, and I'm happy to be here at this Institute of Medicine-sponsored meeting on cancer biomarkers. I'd like to, on my first slide, draw your attention to the URL listed, linus.nci.nih.gov/brb. I will be going over a number of things fairly quickly, and on that website, which is the website of my branch, there's an area called Technical Reports and Talks, where I will be posting the presentation of this talk and also other reprints and technical reports related to the talk. In fact, on the second slide, I show a list of related sort of publications that you may be interested in to hear more details about the kind of things I'll be going over fairly quickly this morning. On the third slide, I would like to make a distinction between two different sort of applications of biomarkers. Biomarkers can be used for a wide variety of different kinds of applications, but I have found that there's a lot of confusion between biomarkers used as surrogate endpoints and biomarkers used as what I would call predictive factors. A surrogate endpoint being a measurement made on a patient, usually before, during, and after treatment, to determine whether the treatment is working. So the surrogate endpoint is either used, could potentially be used as a measure of treatment effect, either for even potentially in phase 3 studies, if you have evidence that it's a valid measure of correlated with a valid measure of patient benefit. But in any case, it's a surrogate endpoint sort of refers to a an outcome measure, whereas a predictive factor is generally a measurement made before treatment to predict whether a particular treatment is likely to be beneficial. These are two dramatically different applications of biomarkers and the kinds of validation or qualification that are appropriate for these two kinds of applications are totally different. Now, even as surrogate endpoints, you can have surrogate endpoints for use in phase 1 and phase 2 studies of a new drug, and some of the kinds of uses that you can make and it would be to determine whether the drug seems to be inhibiting its intended target, and if it's not, you might decide at that point not to pursue phase 3 studies of that drug. Or you may use these, what I might call surrogate or intermediate endpoints, as measures of biological measures of treatment effect. You could use them for selecting doses or selecting dose schedules. In other words, you might pick the smallest dose consistent with what seems to be a complete inhibition of the intended target. For these kinds of uses of what I'd call surrogate or intermediate endpoints can be very useful, and for those kinds of applications, your endpoint doesn't have to be a, quote, validated surrogate. It doesn't have to be something that's validated in sort of the sense that's used in some FDA guidance documents where they talk about validated surrogate or a validated biomarker being a biomarker that's widely accepted in the community as being a measure of disease activity. It's often more difficult to properly validate an endpoint as a surrogate in the sense of that it being for use in phase 3 trials than it is just to use the clinical endpoint in phase 3 trials. Phase 3 trials are supposed to be about determining whether a given treatment used in a given target population results in patient benefit, and so the endpoint is generally an accepted measure of patient benefit. And often there's interest in using shorter-term endpoints that are early measures of patient benefit, but it's showing that something is a valid surrogate for a measure of patient benefit requires measuring both patient benefit and the endpoint in usually several phase 3 trials, some of which did not result in patient benefit and some of which do. And so that tends to be a very difficult and time-consuming process, showing that something is really a valid surrogate for use as an endpoint in phase 3 trials. In fact, show here, there's actually a considerable literature on surrogate endpoints for phase 3 trials, and here's a quote from Tom Fleming that emphasizes one can rarely establish that surrogate endpoints are valid, even in that rare setting in which data on some treatment Z would allow one to view some surrogate S as a valid surrogate for T, the true endpoint. One cannot extrapolate this surrogacy to any new treatment that could have a mechanism of action that differs with those of Z. I would propose that actually for purposes of things like the critical path initiative, relatively early determination of when a treatment is not working and reducing the cost of drug development, since much of the cost of drug development is actually the cost involved in developing drugs that don't work. That seems to be the majority of the drugs that are brought to clinical development. One could use partial surrogates. That is, a partial surrogate would be an intermediate endpoint that would be a necessary but not sufficient condition for improvement of the clinical endpoint. In other words, it might be an indicator of sort of when to continue and when not to continue. If you're not getting a positive signal of an effect of your treatment on the partial surrogate, then you might terminate that trial early, keep its sample size relatively small, not do the long follow-up that might be necessary for really measuring the real clinical endpoint. But if the signal is that your treatment doing good things with regard to your partial surrogate, then you would potentially go ahead and complete that trial, a larger trial, a longer-term trial, to document that, yes, your treatment is effective with regard to a real measure of patient benefit. And use of partial surrogates, they don't have to be validated in the sense that real surrogates would have to be, because you're not really going to base an effectiveness claim on the partial surrogate, but they can be very useful in reducing the cost of clinical development. I'd like to sort of just add my vote to the notion of it's not useful to talk about validation of biomarkers in any absolute sense. Validation is about demonstrating fitness for purpose. And so what we should require in terms of validation of a biomarker should depend very much on the intended purpose of that biomarker. And some of the FDA guidances, when they talk about validation of biomarkers, although they're not stated to be limited to surrogate endpoints, those definitions seem to be perhaps appropriate for phase 3 surrogate endpoints, but not really appropriate and much too stringent for use with treatment predictive biomarkers. Let me now move into the discussion of predictive biomarkers. The conventional wisdom, I think, about clinical trials has been that clinical trials should have broad eligibility criteria, and that one should never believe subset analysis. I think this approach needs reexamination in today's era, when there's increasing evidence that many types of cancers are heterogeneous with regard to pathogenesis and sensitivity to treatment. Next slide, please. Broad eligibility may cause large clinical trials that fail to establish the effectiveness of useful drugs, inconsistency in results among different clinical trials, and post-approval treatment of many patients who don't actually benefit from the approved treatment. The next slide shows some old results for an old NSABP breast cancer trial in which the control group is tamoxifen alone and the two other arms are tamoxifen plus chemotherapy. One was just methotrexate and fluorouracil, and the other was CMF chemotherapy. And this early trial showed very definitively a benefit for chemotherapy for these patients. And but the point I would like to make is that, well, even though the results were highly statistically significant, certainly for disease-free survival or distant disease-free survival, really only perhaps about 5% of the patients actually benefited from chemotherapy, and 85% of the patients really had no recurrence after 5 years just with tamoxifen alone. So very often in cancer treatment, we are treating the majority for the benefit of the minority, and there's a lot of advantage to be gained from being able to identify which patients actually benefit from our treatment. Next slide, please. Cancer clinical trials of molecularly targeted agents may benefit a relatively small population of patients with a given site stage of disease. And Irisa and Herceptin, I think, are two examples. And the benefit for the sensitive subset, however, may be very substantial, much larger than the diluted benefit that you see when you look at the treated group overall. In targeted clinical trials, on the next slide, can be much more efficient than untargeted clinical trials if we know who to target. Next slide, please. In new drug development, the role of a classifier, a biomarker, or a set of biomarkers used in conjunction with each other is a binary classifier. The role of the classifier is to select a target population for treatment. The focus should then be on evaluating the new treatment in that target population, not really so much on validating the classifier, at least in the context of new drug development. And I'd like to sort of introduce propose a couple of developmental strategies for developing new drugs in conjunction with biomarker classifiers that are predictive of who benefits, likely to benefit from that drug. So strategy one is to sort of develop a diagnostic classifier that identifies patients likely to benefit from the new drug. And I'm not going to go into all of the complexities of how one goes about developing such a classifier, because here my focus is going to be on the what comes after the development of that classifier. Then you develop a reproducible assay for the classifier, and you use the diagnostic classifier to restrict eligibility to a prospectively planned evaluation of the new drug and demonstrate that the new drug is effective in the prospectively defined set of patients determined by that diagnostic. And the next slide shows sort of a graphic representation. You develop the predictor of response to a new drug, and I very much want to emphasize the distinction between the developmental studies as compared to the studies where you use that completely specified biomarker classifier in clinical trials that evaluate your treatment. And with this developmental design, number one, you screen the patients with regard to whether they are classifier positive or classifier negative. Classifier positive ones get randomized to either the new drug or the control. Classifier negative ones are not included in the study. And myself and one of my postdocs, we published a couple of papers, which are reprints of which are available on my website. This actually says Clinical Cancer Research 2004, it was actually 2005, evaluating the efficiency of strategy one. And this slide shows the citations to those publications. And what we did was we compared this targeted design, where you restricted accrual to those patients predicted to be responsive to your new drug, to a standard untargeted design with regard to the number of patients required to achieve a fixed statistical power for detecting treatment effectiveness, and with regard to the numbers of patients needed for screening. I'm not going to go into too much detail about the results of that trial in the interest of time. I will show on this slide here comparison of targeted, untargeted designs. This was a table that was actually not included in those two citations that I just showed, but into another paper that will be coming out in Journal of Statistical Planning and Inference. And here, what we use is survival is the endpoint, or disease-free survival, something like that. And we're showing for the targeted design if the treatment effect for marker-positive patients is a reduction in the hazard by 50%, then really the number of events needed for the targeted design is only 74 events. Now, of course, that may be a lot more patients, because depending upon your disease, you may have to enter a lot of patients. You know, most patients may not result in recurrence events, but it's an order of magnitude at least smaller than the number you would need for a traditional untargeted design. I would point out that for Herceptin in node-positive primary breast cancer, the treatment hazard ratio for marker-positive patients is about 0.5, and about 25 to 30% of the patients are marker positive. So, if you did an untargeted trial, you would require 720 events, which is an order of magnitude more than the 74 for the targeted trial. I won't go over this table on the next slide, which shows the ratio of number of untargeted to number of targeted patients for trials with binary endpoints, except to indicate, and we looked at this in two ways. One, assuming that the patients, classifier negative patients, there was no treatment effect for them, and the other case under the assumption that for the classifier negative patients, the treatment effect of the new treatment compared to the control was half as great as it was for the classifier positive patients. In both cases, there's a sort of overwhelming effect of the targeted design in reducing the required sample size. Next slide, please. So for Herceptin, even a relatively poor assay at that time enabled the conduct of a targeted phase 3 trial in metastatic breast cancer, which was crucial for establishing the effectiveness of the drug. I was actually on the Oncologic Drug Advisory Committee at that time that recommended approval of the drug. Recent results with Herceptin in early stage breast cancer show dramatic benefits for patients selected to overexpress HER2. Now, the next slide shows a different developmental strategy in which, and this would be, I think, for a fairly common situation where you don't have so much confidence in your diagnostic classifier, your biomarker classifier, that you want to use it to restrict eligibility. So the idea here is you would develop your classifier, your predictor of response to the new therapy, and you would then, but you would randomize both patients who are classifier positive and who are classifier negative. Or in fact, you might just collect specimens from all the patients and actually not even do the assay until the final analysis of the trial. So all patients get randomized either to the new treatment or the control. But you have a completely well-defined diagnostic classifier before you start the trial. And so the developmental strategy here is not to use the diagnostic to restrict eligibility, but to structure a prospective analysis plan. The analysis plan I'm I'm going to describe here is not the only possible analysis plan, but it's one I want to propose. And that is, you compare the new drug to the control overall for all randomized patients, ignoring the classifier. But you use a threshold significance level of 0.04 rather than the traditional 0.05. And so if your new treatment is significantly better than the control with regard to your primary endpoint at a p-value less than or equal to 0.04, then you claim effectiveness for the eligible population as a whole. Otherwise, you perform a single subset analysis evaluating the new drug in the classifier-positive patients, and for that subset analysis, you use a threshold significance of 0.01, and you claim effectiveness if that treatment compared to control is significantly different in that subset at the 0.01 level or better, you claim effectiveness for the classifier-positive patients. And overall, you preserve a type 1 error, false positive rate of no greater than 5%, since you've done two tests, potentially two tests, but you've allocated your 0.05 between these two tests. So some of the key features of this design, well, the purpose of the randomized clinical trial is to evaluate the treatment versus the control overall and for the predefined subset, not to reevaluate the components of the classifier. For example, if it's an expression profile-based classifier, the purpose of the trial is not to reevaluate those components or to modify or refine the classifier. Some of the other key features are a completely pre-specified analysis plan, a single predefined subset, overall study type 1 error of 0.05 split between the overall test and the subset test. Saying that the study should be stratified is not sufficient. It doesn't matter whether randomization is stratified, except that it helps ensure that all patients have specimens available to assay for classification. What does matter is that you have a completely well-defined analysis plan. So the roadmap here is to develop a completely specified genomic classifier of the patients likely to benefit from a new treatment, to establish reproducibility of measurement of the classifier, to use the completely specified classifier to design and analyze a new clinical trial to evaluate effectiveness of the new treatment with a predefined analysis plan. That's the roadmap. The next slide sort of just indicates those three steps graphically. And the next slide highlights the guiding principle that the data used to develop the classifier must be distinct from the data used to test hypotheses about treatment effect in subsets determined by the classifier. Developmental studies are exploratory, the studies developing the classifier. The studies on which treatment effectiveness claims are to be based should be definitive studies that test a treatment hypothesis in a patient population completely pre-specified by the classifier. The next slide addresses the issue of archived samples. Archived samples from a conventional non-targeted negative clinical trial can be used to develop a binary classifier of a subset thought to benefit from treatment. That subset hypothesis should be tested in a separate clinical trial. It could either be a prospective targeted type 1 trial or a prospective type 2 trial, or it could be analysis of archived specimens from a second previously conducted clinical trial to identify classifier positive patients. Next slide discusses just a little bit about the development of genomic classifiers. Often they're one of two types, either single gene or single protein biomarkers based on knowledge of the therapeutic target, or empirically determined based on correlating gene expression or genotype to patient outcome after treatment. They can be developed either during phase 1-2 development or after a failed phase 3 trial using archived specimens. The next slide discusses a little bit about DNA microarray expression profiling. I think these are mostly useful for settings where you don't know how to identify the patients likely to be responsive to the new treatment based on its mechanism of action. It does have the advantage that only pretreatment specimens are needed. I'm trying to emphasize we're talking about predictive biomarkers, not surrogate outcome measures. So only pretreatment specimens are needed. If you're predicting, you have to predict before you treat, based on data available before you treat. Expression profiling should be used to identify informative genes and to form a binary classifier that can be used to select patients for study or for a predefined subset analysis. A set of genes is not a classifier, so you can select the informative genes, but then you have to sort of put their expression levels together into some completely specified binary classifier. The next slide tries to emphasize that there should be no requirement for demonstrating that the classifier or any of its components are validated biomarkers of disease status in the sense that's discussed in several FDA guidances. I think those criteria are not appropriate to predictive biomarkers, and I think if they are applied to predictive biomarkers, they will essentially halt promising, halt our opportunity to make rapid progress in bringing about a more personalized form of medicine. There should also be no requirement for demonstrating that repeating the classifier development process on independent data results in the same classifier. There are good statistical reasons why it almost never will result in the same classifier. If you really repeat the whole process, certainly if you're talking about a gene expression-based classifier. And that's really not what validation should mean for a predictive classifier. It should mean more that it could mean that if you predict with independent set of patients that you still have accurate predictions, but it shouldn't mean that if you repeat the process of classifier development that you would get the same process. And there should be no requirement for FDA regulation of how DNA microarrays are used for classifier development. I think the field is not ready for regulating how classifiers are developed. So in conclusion, new technology and biological knowledge make it increasingly feasible to identify which patients are most likely to benefit or suffer severe adverse events from a new treatment. There are many practical obstacles, such as access to tissue, and we do need better technology in the sense of being able to do expression profiling on archived tissue. But the technology and the biological knowledge really have come a long way, and we have tools in our hands now that really permit us to make progress in predicting who's likely to respond or to a new treatment. FDA can either expedite or slow effective utilization of this technology. They might slow it by over-regulating classifier development or not providing sponsors with a clear and practical roadmap of what is required. Targeting treatment can greatly improve the therapeutic ratio of benefit to adverse events. Smaller clinical trials are needed. Treated patients are more likely to benefit. And there's also can be a huge economic benefit for society. Next slide, please. Much of the conventional wisdom about how to develop and utilize biomarkers is flawed and does not lead to definitive evidence of treatment benefit for a well-defined population. Some aspects of the guidelines of the FDA on biomarkers are inappropriate for treatment selection biomarkers. Next slide, please. Technology is sufficiently mature today to effectively identify which patients benefit from new treatments and to dramatically improve the efficiency of clinical trials. What is lacking today is leadership in establishing specific guidelines for the design and analysis of adequate clinical trials that test new treatments in patient populations predefined based on completely specified diagnostic classifiers. Trial designs are available that will support broad labeling indications in cases where drug activity is sufficient and provide strong evidence of effectiveness for a prospectively defined subset where appropriate. Next slide, please. Prospectively specified analysis plans for phase 3 trials are essential to achieve reliable results. Biomarker analysis does not mean exploratory analysis, except in developmental studies. Biomarker classifiers used in phase 3 evaluations should be completely specified based on external data, data external to those phase 3 studies. In some cases, definitive evidence can be achieved from prospective analysis of patients in previously conducted clinical trials with extensive archival of pretreatment specimens. Thank you very much.